I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Bill Dost. Bill got his start in the asset finance field over 18 years ago. He started his current company, D&D Leasing, in Canada in 2000 and expanded into the United Kingdom in 2009 when he opened D&D Leasing UK. Bill sits on a number of boards. He's also very active in the community and holds an annual charity event to raise awareness and funds for small and often unknown charities. Among other degrees, Bill holds a doctorate of theology and an MBA in human resource management. He's a lifelong learner. He's involved in lots of other educational activities at the moment, which we may talk about during the course of this episode. And I know, in addition to lots of the activities that he's involved with in his community, his past board experience includes a 9-year period as an advisory board member for Liberty International Church. And Bill, you and I have been connected through a mutual colleague who was a guest on Smashing the Plateau in a different episode, and I'm really grateful that we have this connection, and I'm grateful to have you on today. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, David.
So I wonder if we could start off by talking about what you would consider to be your perfect moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, my perfect moment is really just cuddling in bed with my four children. And then, usually I recognize at some point there that I need to get up. And
yeah, that's kind of a bummer, but it does have to happen at some point.
Yeah, but, I'm very driven. And my driving force is that, our entire belief system for our business is that we want to change the lives of 1 million entrepreneurs. And we have this drive to make the world better. And the only way that we can do that is that I have to get up and I have to go and do certain things in the office. And as a finance company that helps small and medium enterprise, meet their needs and help them achieve their dreams, I have to go and do that so that other dads can be in beds with their kids and getting to enjoy whatever their perfect moments may be. And so, that realization hits me every morning. And so that's sort of a perfect moment for me.
And the reason why I wanted to start off by talking about your perfect moment is you wrote this really lovely blog post about the perfect moment. And one of the things that I hear really frequently from entrepreneurs is this struggle of trying to create what we consider to be a healthy balance between our work life or our business life and our personal lives, what we do with our friends, our family, our communities. And it's, it's interesting that success for many people in the business world, you immediately think about financial success and the bottom line. And when I have discussions with entrepreneurs, particularly when you start talking about the why, like why are you in business? What is it you're really trying to achieve? Being an entrepreneur is hard. Being an employee is way easier, right? So when we start to probe and talk about these things, the answer is hardly ever about the money. Particularly as entrepreneurs get older, the more they realize there's way more to life than money. So I love that blog post that you wrote, and I'd like that you want to impact other entrepreneurs, and you see that there's a struggle between what you do personally and what you're trying to do in your business life, and that everybody else goes through that. So thank you for sharing your own perfect moment. So speaking about being an entrepreneur and the fact that it's hard, talk to me a little bit about your own evolution, your own history, and your own track record, and specifically, I know you've had a lot of successes. What I'd love to hear is a little bit about your own story and maybe some of the ups and downs.
Sure. I'm a big proponent of believing and that we learn more from the failures than we do the successes. So I'm happy to share with you my failures. I think the easiest and best failure to tell you about is when we expanded to the UK in 2009. And that really started with, a couple years of buildup. We were searching for additional funding, to take a step back, we're actually a finance house. So we provide funding via lease and via loan to small and medium enterprises. And to make that really simple, if you were a business that was under, let's say, $2 million in revenue, and you wanted to purchase a piece of equipment, let's say a computer system or a truck, so anything under $100,000, you'd come to somebody like me or a CIT or DeLaga Landon or your bank. Anyhow, that's what we do for a living. So we were expanding from Canada and we were trying to grow larger. And so we were looking for money. And so what ended up happening is we found a family trust that said, yeah, we'll back you. Go ahead and look at expansion. And the United States at the time frightened us. At the time, the credit, it wasn't the credit crisis, it's probably the credit glut. People were giving money away. And so that was happening. We just couldn't compete with our competitors. And so we looked at the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom looked like it was a good market to go into. And we said, okay, we took this this family trust money. We backed it with a U.S. bank. And we decided to go ahead and open up in the U.S. And by the time we got everything in a row.
You mean the U.K.?
Sorry, yes. And we went into the United Kingdom. And by the time we'd gotten ready and gotten into the United Kingdom and we're ready to draw down against the bank with this $10 million line, the bank said, oh, I'm sorry, have you not been watching? Have you not noticed that Lehman Brothers no longer exists and Bear Stearns has fallen over? Your $10 million line no longer exists. And so we were now in the United Kingdom with our family trust money that had lent us money, with a full complement of staff. We'd spent a gaggle of money setting up the company in the United Kingdom and no funding money. And so that was very, very tough days. And it was very, very frightening days because you go, we've got our working capital money has now become our funding money. And you still get the sweats talking about it, quite frankly, because you remember the days when you're going, okay, so what do we do? We can't now stop what we're doing because we've borrowed this money and spent it, a lot of it, from this fund. And we've hired these people away from other jobs. We have to proceed forward. And so we were consistently on the lookout for money and consistently just going out there and just beating on doors trying to get deal flow. And it was tough days.
It sounds actually pretty scary.
Yeah, horrendous. I told my wife when we moved into our house, and we were building a house in Canada. So I told her at the time when we moved in not to unpack. So it gives you an idea.
So how did you get past that?
Well, it was a number of things. Number one, we spoke to a number of our Canadian funders. And we dealt with a lot of the high net worth community, and so we retrenched them from the Canadian business into the UK business. But at that point the world had turned, and so a number of them just wanted to retrench their money and just hold on to it as well. And we found high net worths in the UK, and we offered them really obscene interest rates, and we were able to bring a couple of them on board. And so I can't say that we were a rousing success in the early days in the UK, but we got through. And we got through to a point that, a couple of years later, we were able to start getting institutional money, probably more than a couple of years. It probably took about 3 years. And then we started getting institutional money because everybody wants to see you go through a cycle. So it was pretty lean days, but we were able to bring in enough in, high net worths that we were able to get through those days.
So what were some of the thoughts that went through your mind before you had a potential solution, or at least a plan B?
Outside of how high was the life insurance? No, in jest, obviously. But I think the biggest thought was, can I give the original seed money back? And when we realized that no, we couldn't give the original seed money back, we're locked in here. It was, let's go hit all the banks. So we spoke to every single bank that was out there. Meanwhile, my sales team was instructed to go out there and sell as quick as possible to drive revenue so that we could show that we did have a revenue base. And the idea was to say, look, we've been doing this in Canada for so long, we know how to develop a portfolio and a book. Because the principles of our lending business was still a good business. And what we'd always done worked. So the business wasn't bad. It was just that the world around us was falling apart. That wasn't our fault. So we took control of what we could control. And the stuff that we couldn't control, we let go of. The next thing we did, really, was that we hired a firm that could understand that was good at raising money, that was from within our industry. And they were able to say, okay, well, we'll put you in touch with people that actually lend money into your industry. And so they just went through their Rolodex and then started just introducing themselves to people while we introduced ourselves to people. And we networked like crazy and just dug into every single contact that we could and just went and met people like crazy. And so every high net worth investor we could bring on board, you know, we would bring them on board until we found an institution that went yes. And that first institution that came on board was a public company, which was great. Well, they were owned rather by a public company, but they were a bank. And then that led to the next one, which led to the next one. So while it took time, it was the right moves.
But it's interesting.
It was just hard.
I'm sure it was really hard. I can only imagine. But it's interesting that the two steps that you just described, control what you can and then get good targeted help, where you don't have the specialization, but you need it.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, I think there's this thought process sometimes that people panic or they start throwing mud on the wall. And I'm not saying that we didn't do that in the beginning, but you can only do that for, what, a week? After that, you realize that, okay, we need to get serious about things, right? And so you just get serious about things and say, okay, you know, this problem's not going to just go away. I don't believe in magic bullets. And so, yeah, and, you know, either you decide to give yourself an ulcer or not. And so we decided just to control what you could.
That's really smart. Yeah, because I've seen companies that when they have these kind of unexpected situations come up, they spend way too much time chasing their own tail and not doing exactly what you did, which is control what you can and then get good targeted help for the rest.
Yeah. And you know, in all fairness, my faith plays a lot in that too, because, you know, being a Christian and having, you know, an advanced degree in theology, we were on our knees, you know, and we were praying, just asking for help.
So speaking of which, what are the connections between theology and finance?
Yeah, it's a nice tension, isn't it? Well, you know, the background is I became a Christian when I was 21. And I probably entered finance not too long after that. The connections between it are what you see probably in the business now a little more, which is our bent towards sort of a social justice and a social lend. We lend towards the small entrepreneur. We go towards the entrepreneur and the business that the banks don't want to help. Not because they've got bad credit, but because banks don't particularly want to take risk, you know. And the things that excite me about lending today are about being able to go into foreign countries like, you know, or I should say third world areas like Africa and India, where we can actually make real dents in the economy and in poverty even. Because when you lend to, say, you know, somebody in Africa, India, because you can do some really, really great things in the way I believe. And so long term, what D&D Leasing wants to do is to start making real social impact. Now, a great example is this. If you go into a region like Africa or a country like India, and you provide finance to a small entrepreneur who is a one-man band, and they start to succeed, typically what they'll do is they'll hire two other people. So there'll be now a three-man band. And what will happen is that they'll lift all three of them above the line of poverty. because that's what happens when success happens on small levels.
Right.
And then you can do that again and again and again. And so the call in the finance world right now is for finance companies of the West, whether it's Western Europe or whether it's North America, to come into these regions. Unfortunately, a lot of those companies are unwilling and have been unwilling because nobody wants to be big conglomerates going in this way, A, and B, because a lot of the credit rating agencies just don't exist, especially in areas like India and Africa. And then C, you know, there is some legalities about how, you know, interest and some of that stuff works for some of the bigger guys. Guys like us who have been screaming about this for 5-6 years that we want to go in there, we want to do this, support us in doing it, have the expertise. We know how to do small ticket. We just don't want to do big ticket. And the bigger guys want to do the big ticket stuff. They want to get into the public sector where they'll make the money, but the small guys will never get help. So recently UBS, this is when I say recently, last year just released a study that there's something like a $50 billion shortfall or $500 billion shortfall. Forgive me, I don't have the study in front of me. In Africa alone, that needs to be addressed just for entrepreneurs being financed. So they're going and they're offering what they call impact investment now in Europe, where they'll give you, you know, a 3% return on your money if you'll just land in, if you're a high net worth individual, into Africa, because they see that this money is needed down there just to help entrepreneurs go, because they see that the cycle of poverty can now be broken. That's what excites me. That's what drives me every morning. So you ask how, you know, finance and theology can mix. For me, it's about changing the lives of people. And my that's about my faith, really. It's about making the world a better place. Sort of a roundabout answer for you, but I suppose.
No, actually, it's a really inspiring answer. Because it's making changes that are totally on the grassroots level. All over the world.
Yeah, that's how I look at it.
Interesting. And where do you have staff?
So currently we have two offices. We're in Canada. We're in the United Kingdom. Our next play will be in the United States because we need to have the global size. And then we'll start going to Eastern Europe. And then willingly we'll go into India and Africa is where we want to go.
Sounds great. What have been some of your own experiences with trying to smash the plateau for your own company?
Well, you know, it's been interesting, right? Because, you know, you hit up against the plateau and it's like, well, where am I stuck? Why am I stuck? And how do I get unstuck?
Exactly. That's the question.
I think the biggest question I've always had is figuring out the question, where am I stuck? And so my biggest sticking point for us now, again, as a finance company, it's going to kind of throw it on its end, right? The biggest places that we've been stuck is being able to raise more funds, right? So the best example was the horror story I told you, which was, man, we were out of money. Not out of money, but, you know, here we are in the United Kingdom, and we've lost this funding line. What do we do? I think the next biggest example, not to, because I don't want to use the same one, is that you go, okay, we've now been given a great big wad of money. Now go sell it. And we find out that the world's changed again. And now the rate of interest that we sell it at doesn't fit. So how do we now change something that we haven't changed in 5 years? And you go, okay, well, who do you talk to? And so thankfully we have two forums open to us. One is the Entrepreneurs Organization. That's been really, really great with us, or for us. And I'd be remiss if I didn't really plug them. And I've had a great group in my forum where I've always been able to sit down with and say, hey, here's what's going on in my business and in my life. But the second forum I have is the Asset Finance Directors, which is the Asset Finance Directors is within my organization, within my industry, I should say, where we sit down on a quarterly basis and sort of talk shop about the industry. And that's where we learn that, hey, the industry is changing, interest rates are dropping, and we need to smarten up and change our rates as well. And that's where you figure out that, hey, having all the money in the world is great as long as you can sell it. And so that was the next time we needed to sort of change, you know, for us, the plateau. Or the next place that we were stuck was, hey, it's great to have money, but if you can't move that money, you know, it's no good having it. So, yeah, that was a fun one as well. But we got through it, right? Because for us, and I think that the best example of that, to give a story, is that we had two of our best customers were bought virtually overnight by hedge funds in basically over a holiday period, and came back as funders over that holiday period. And it basically shocked the marketplace. And you come back going, okay, so these guys used to buy from us. So they're basically aggregated buyers from us, and they would go and distribute to the customers, right? And you're going, okay, now they don't need us because they've got their own source of funds. And you're going, okay, well, the market's now changed like completely overnight because now they don't need us, so they've now dropped like a level of like a pay grade level. Do you know what I mean? Like a level of funding. So it's an interesting place to be. Things will happen in business. So we tend not to let it phase us. I think we just need to keep moving and stay agile. All you can be is try to be really consistent and try to improve your systems and try to improve the best that you be the best that you can be.
So, Bill, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. What's exciting, and what do we have to look forward to in the near future?
Absolutely. So I'm actually working on a book, and I'm doing a series of talks right now. During the credit crisis, I alluded to the fact that obviously, you know, we lost an amount of funding through one of our banks when we opened up in the United Kingdom. And what I didn't really allude to is that actually led me down a bit of a rabbit trail between myself and my wife. And through a number of events, it actually took us and our marriage into some really, really dark territory. You know, it was a very, very difficult time. And to say that we were on the rocks is probably a bit of an understatement. But thankfully, we were able to come back from it. And one of the big things that we realized that is that our story really wasn't unique, in that not just couples, but entrepreneurs very, very specifically go through a lot of ups and downs in their relationships. And so my wife and I decided that this is something that really needed to be spoken about and not really sort of swept under the carpet. And so I started to do a lot of study on marriage, relationships, and entrepreneurs, mainly for ourselves, primarily, just to get ourselves back on track. And there's a doctor by the name of John Gottman who wrote a fabulous book called The 7 Principles of Making Marriage Work. He's also profiled in the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. And he just talks about, you know, keys on making marriage work. But one of the neat things he talks about is that in a society today where we think that, you know, marriages are getting better and better, he actually followed marriage over a 40-year period in specific couples and found that the incidence of divorce is at about 68% for first-timers, and it goes up to 70% for second-timers. And everything that I've studied shows that entrepreneurs are worse. So what I've done is I've taken my story, and I've put it into basically a 45-minute talk. And I go around and I talk to entrepreneurs and other business people. And we use our story as a backdrop, telling people, you know, here's the sort of the warning signs to watch out for on what you can do to your marriage and how to destroy your marriage. And then we pause. And then we look at how, you know, just key tricks and key things that you can do to actually make your marriage not just work, but make it much, much better. And why you might want to do that, not just from a net worth standpoint, but how to be happier, live longer, and to be better just overall. So I found that really, really fulfilling. I've been pushed to start writing books, so I'm trying to do that. And I'm just going as often as I can to just to talk and tell people about, you know, you can be happy in marriage, and it can be really, really fulfilling. And so that's really where a lot of my passion is, and I'm quite excited about it.
You know, it's really interesting, Bill. One of the things that I talk about with clients all the time is what they deem to be greater success. Because in order to smash the plateau, what you're trying to do is create greater success. And one of the interesting things is the definition that entrepreneurs typically give me about success may have a financial component. Often that's not the most important one. Personal relationships comes in all the time, and it's and I know that it's really hard to manage personal relationships and manage business simultaneously. There are often conflicts.
Absolutely. Well, we start the talk off defining success and what is success to you. And it splits the room. A lot of people will say, and perhaps some of them are younger, will say, you know, obviously the finance side or creating my baby to a point that I can do something with it, you know, the business. But a lot of people are really getting to the point where they're saying, you know, my relationships are really where it's at. And how do I make sure that I'm not, you know, killing it or drowning it in the early stages of my business? Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear that you are sharing your message with the world based on your own personal experiences. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.